right there is what winter actually feels like. Below zero, cold, deeply, deeply cold, bone chilling, like to the point where you walk outside. I walked out this morning to start my vehicle, had my coat on, could feel, it was like I wasn't wearing a coat, could feel the cold through every layer that I had, like immediately. That's living in Minnesota for you. But I'll tell you what, I will take it. I will take it.
I mean, it shouldn't be surprising this time of year. It's always the coldest the week between Christmas and New Year's because of the solstice. It just kind of bottoms out.
Absolutely. The way I look at it, there are two basic geographical distinctions in the United States of America. Snow and snakes. Those are that's the two different places you can find yourself in. And I will take the snow over the snakes.
Me too.
Absolutely. As my father-in-law put it over Christmas conversation, he's like, I like the cold because it kills things. I thought that was an elegant way to put it. Absolutely.
I mean, you can wake up to like a little cold coming through the window, or you can wake up to a cockroach in your basement.
Right.
Take your pick.
Exactly. I'm a big fan of knowing, of control. Let's put it this way. Controlling what varmints are in my home. I would exert even more control than there currently is if it was up to me, but it's not. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream us. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. Hope you had a good Christmas. How was your Christmas, Brad? Did you enjoy yourself? Have a good time? Get some good presents?
Yeah, I did. I mean, my family just did the usual, which is always great.
Yeah.
And, I enjoyed my time off of work and happy to be back.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's definitely one of those things that it's nice. Every aspect of it is nice. The anticipation, the doing, the coming back. All of that has its own virtues. I enjoyed my time as well. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. You can search for podcasts of past shows right there in your iHeartRadio app by doing a search for Closing Argument, and our channel will pop right up. Brad Omlin is taking your calls and producing the program. So I want to introduce you guys to a gal that I had not heard of before today, and I'm willing to bet you haven't heard of her either. Her name is Anya Muzicek, and I have that verified pronunciation. I actually went on YouTube to figure out how you pronounce this gal's name. She's Russian, and I hadn't heard of her before today. I'm guessing you haven't heard of her before, but she is a distinguished individual. One thing I can tell you, one thing I'm pretty confident of, is that at no point in my life will I ever be named by a credible authority the Grand Master of anything. I am never going to assume the title of Grand Master in any human endeavor. But this gal, at the age of 27, has. Reading from her Wikipedia page, Anya Olgavinya Muzicek is a Ukrainian chess grandmaster. From 2004 to 2014, she played for Slovenia. She is the fourth woman to cross the 2600 ELO rating mark, having achieved a rating of 2606 in July 2012. Now, I don't know what an ELO rating is or how impressed I should be by a 2606, but I'm going to take their word for it that that is impressive. Because, again, she's achieved the rank of Grand Master at the age of 27. Very accomplished. She was taught to play chess at the age of 2 by her parents, both professional chess coaches. She played her first tournament at 5, and in the same year, she placed 2nd in the under-10 girls championship. She has won the Women's World Rapid Chess Championship in 2016 and the Women's World Blitz Chess Championship twice in 2014. And 2016. Now, why am I introducing you to this young lady grandmaster of chess? Well, she took to social media recently, just before the holidays, to take a stand, a very particular stand, which on its face you might think would warrant a lot of attention, particularly from those in our discourse who identify themselves as champions of women's rights, who identify themselves as feminists, who claim to be concerned primarily with equality and rights and the treatment of women with respect and what have you, particularly in the wake of all these accusations of sexual misconduct and people getting fired, the narrative changing, senators having to resign and what have you. You would think that a story like this would fit in well with that narrative. Here's what Anya Muzicek chess grand champion had to say just a couple of days before Christmas. She said, "In a few days, I am going to lose two world champion titles, one by one, just because I decided not to go to Saudi Arabia, not to play by someone's rules, not to wear abaya, not to be accompanied getting outside, and altogether not to feel myself a secondary creature. Exactly 1 year ago, I won these two titles and was about the happiest person in the chess world, but this time I feel really bad. I am ready to stand for my principles, to skip the event, where in 5 days I was expected to earn more than I do in a dozen of events combined. All that is annoying, but the most upsetting thing is that almost nobody really cares. That is a really bitter feeling. Still not the one to change my opinion and my principles. The same goes for my sister, Maria. And I am really happy that we share this point of view. And yes, for those few who care, we'll be back." And that's the extent of it. You know, I did some Googling. I tried to find if she has a web page or a publicist or, you know, anything along those lines. Apparently, being a grandmaster of chess is not enough to warrant, like, having people who kind of, like, manage your affairs. Either that or I just couldn't find them in the 5 minutes that I gave it. But the point being, the gal is going out on a limb here, right? Like, this is actual risk-taking. This is actual sacrifice in the sense of giving something up because it serves a higher value. And, you know, all of the kind of the demonstrations that we see from those on the political left, particularly in this country, directed at our own culture, directed at our own institutions, directed at Hollywood or Washington or big business or white people generally or men generally or cisgender people or whatever the case may be. All of that takes no risk whatsoever. None. You risk precisely nothing when you go on social media and you take some, quote, principled, unquote, stand against the patriarchy or white supremacy or, you know, whatever the cause du jour on the left is. Because the vast majority of the culture and the media, at least the media culture, let's put it that way, is going to stand by you and uphold you and applaud you and talk about how brilliant you are. Not only that, but you actually have a shot. You know, it's kind of like spinning the wheel of fortune. You actually have a shot to advance yourself by taking such a stand. Like, you can become a celebrity by virtue. Look at this kid just recently. I don't think we talked about him here on this program. I don't even know the kid's name. But he was making headlines last week or the week before because his mom took video of him and put it all over social media of him crying about having been bullied in school, right? He became a celebrity. He was getting phone calls from, you know, different personages, politicians, you know, being invited to, I think Mike Pence invited him to the White House and all this happening. You're not taking a risk by speaking out against American oppression.
His name is Keaton Jones.
Keaton Jones. You're not taking a risk by speaking out against what you perceive to be oppression within the context of the United States, because not only are you not likely to lose anything at all, but there's a chance you might actually gain something. You might actually gain prominence. You might actually gain a platform, gain a stage. And so there's nothing risked there at all. By contrast, this gal, Anya Muzicek, chess grandmaster, accomplished chess player, is taking a principled stand that is going to cost her two world championships, that's going to cost her a massive paycheck, and that she gets no reward for whatsoever. Like, she's got some likes, you know, she's got like almost 5,000 likes on Facebook. That's her reward.
Well, and I think the fact that she's not getting press for this, is, you know, here in America, speaks volumes of just the pure ethnocentricity that the left has.
Yes.
Like, I remember one of my friends on Facebook was talking about, like, why don't black people care about issues in Africa?
Because
people in America are still ethnocentric, just
right.
as everybody in America is ethnocentric.
Excellent, excellent point.
And the causes of oppression don't, or the causes that we deem worthy of our attention in the United States, like, don't cross socioeconomic lines and don't cross oceans.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and that's just it, is the overriding point that I'm trying to convey to you here by citing Anya's story is precisely what Brad just articulated, which is that all this hand-wringing and all this feigned concern, and you see it on social media every single day, the latest outrage, the latest cause du jour, the latest reason why we need to something simply must be done about the patriarchy or about white supremacy or about whatever the case may be. It's all fake. It's all fake. None of these people who claim to care about equality and rights and justice actually care about those things at all. At all, in the least. Not even a little bit. Not even a little bit. Because if they did, if they actually cared about equality and rights and justice, they would focus on the areas of society and the areas of our world where there was actually atrocities to undo currently, right? Like, instead of talking about, let's put it this way, instead of talking about historic chattel slavery from 1792, right, we would be talking about the fact that people are currently being human trafficked. People are currently being enslaved throughout the world. That in the United States of America, we have policies which either ignore or sanction various degrees of enslavement of human beings. And we'd be working to do something about it. But that's not the point. The point isn't to do something. The point isn't to actually advance liberty and equality and justice. That's not it. The point is to undermine the status quo, to undermine the institutions which act as pillars upholding Western civilization, and to do so for political purpose so that the people who are engaged in such activism can seize power with which to enrich themselves and to punish their enemies. That's what this is about. So stop falling for the lie. Don't let yourself be fooled. You know, the next time some feminist comes at you talking about the patriarchy, point her to Anya Musicek. And, you know, watch her go, huh? Who? Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. 651-989-5855, the number to join us, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So we started off the show this evening talking about Anya Musicek, a grandmaster of chess. Grandmaster. That's a title that you just don't hear a lot these days. There aren't many things you can be a grandmaster of other than chess that I'm aware of. I mean, you know, Jedi, but those aren't real. So, good on her. 27 years old. Wow, that's absolutely amazing. But we brought you her story because it's indicative of the kind of story that breaks the narrative of the left in terms of their fake concern over equality and rights and justice and racial disparities and what have you. I have another story here that's local that also breaks the mold. Now, I'm going to read this to you, and I'm going to give away the spoiler right now. By time I get to the end of it, you're still not going to know what the story's actually about, or at least why it is that we're talking about it. But I want you to pay attention and see if you can discern what's missing from this story, all right? By the way, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. You can join us at 651-989-5855. This comes to us from the local ABC affiliate. A Minneapolis woman who was stabbed 14 times while walking to her uptown home said she's doing better and is focused on helping police catch her attacker. 26-year-old Morgan Evanson said she was attacked December 13th while walking home from her job at the Apple Store on Hennepin Avenue. Evanson told KSTP she struggled with her attacker at the corner of 32nd Street and Fremont Avenue, and she considers herself lucky to be alive. It was horrifying because I could feel something that felt like it was stinging me, but it was him stabbing me, she said. Doctors told me I had 14 wounds that needed stitches, including a lacerated kidney. Evanson told KSTP Her main concern now is getting better and helping police find whoever did this so he cannot do it again. I cannot imagine anyone attacking someone like that, and as a woman, it is especially frightening, but I knew I had to fight back, and I want him to know I am okay and that he will be caught, Evanson said. Evanson said she is extremely grateful to neighbors and passersby who heard her screaming and came to her aid, which she said ultimately led to her attacker running away. Now, the thing about this is, in that story, what is missing? What is missing? How about a description of who the attacker was? What he looked like? What his physical attributes were? I mean, if for no other reason than, I don't know, getting the word out to the public that maybe they ought to be looking for somebody who's going around stabbing random women 14 times. I mean, that seems relevant to me, right? That seems newsworthy, does it not? Now, to their credit, the local ABC affiliate in their televised version of this story did provide the description of the individual, the subject, the suspect in question. Turns out he is a Somali man in his early 20s, 5'7", was wearing an army green jacket and stone-washed jeans. Conspicuously missing from the text version, the online version of their story, and to my knowledge, I have seen little to no coverage of this incident whatsoever. You would think a woman getting stabbed, and again, this goes back to the Anya Musicek thing, a woman getting stabbed 14 times. You'd think that would have a little bit of focus in the news, right? It might be the subject of a story or two, right? Some sort of concern or expression of solidarity or you know, remark from a politician or whatever the case may be. But, you know, we're not talking about this in the broader discourse. I wonder why. I wonder why. Now, listen. I am not suggesting, and I would not condone, using this incident to try to paint all Somali men or all Somalis as somehow being criminal or somehow being more suspect generally than any other segment of the population. My point here is that we're the shoe on the other foot, so to speak. We all know how this would be going down, right? If it was a Somali woman who had been stabbed randomly 14 times by a white guy, holy smokes. This would be on the cover of every news article, every news magazine publication. It would be running on all the national cable shows. It would be the subject of press releases from every organization known to man. Politicians would be chiming in. There'd already be a law named after this gal that had been submitted, introduced, ready to go to committee, right? To do something about it. But because the racial polarity is reversed, because this is a not just black on white crime, but foreigner on native crime, that is a third rail that nobody's willing to touch.
Is it possible, though, too, that it's not getting any coverage because it's Christmas?
Yeah, but I mean, there's a lot of other things that are getting coverage. When I say coverage, like, the Star Tribune is still publishing things, right? Like,
yeah.
The Fox News is still running stories. Things are still getting talked about. So, I mean, the idea that it's only because of the season that it's not getting covered. I think that if you drop this in any other time of the year, the relative response would be the same. And this is just the most recent example of this kind of double standard of how a story is treated, how a story is framed. The racial polarity, I mean, remember when we talked about during the midst of Charlottesville? Right smack in the middle of Charlottesville, there was a rally somewhere down there south. I don't think it was actually in Charlottesville, but it was close by in the south, where the president or the leader of some black nationalist organization had a joint press conference with the leader of a white supremacist organization. And the whole point of their joint press conference was to talk about how we need to settle down and we need to be peaceful and we need to be nonviolent. That's extraordinarily newsworthy. There's nothing about that that's not newsworthy. And it's relevant to exactly what was going on at the time. And better yet, it would actually have a positive effect on the discourse to highlight that, to write about it, to talk about it, to interview them, to get their story, to find out who they are and how they came to their views, how they came to decide to have a joint press conference. That's interesting. That's fascinating. Nothing. Nothing in the media. I tripped upon it randomly and talked about it here on the program. I happened to see it in one of my social media news feeds. Otherwise, I never would have known about it. This bias is real. And it's not just a bias of politics, although that's certainly there. It's also a bias of what is going to inflame the conversation versus what's going to calm it down, number one, and also what's going to be subversive and countercultural versus affirming what the majority may or may not think. We'll talk to Corey from Bloomington when we return and take your calls at 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855, the number to join us. Appreciate you tuning in, as always. Let's go to Corey in Bloomington. Welcome to the program. How are you doing tonight, Corey?
Good. How are you doing, Walter?
I'm doing all right. What's on your mind?
Are you a black man?
We had established this, but yes. Yes, I am.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Anything else tonight?
Oh, no. I was wondering what was going on with the Democrats. Since they were the ones that did the whole Jim Crow thing and all that, so they think they're going to pick up any seats because whoever they got in Alabama.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in what you just said, but let's start with where you began with the history of the Democratic Party. They would say, and we've had Jamar in here. You know Jamar. He's addressed that issue. And he'd say, well, that polarity shifted during the Civil Rights era, that all the racists went from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party after Civil Rights, which is an interesting argument that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, seeing as how why would you go from the party that was not fighting all the racist stuff to the party that was? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But that's their argument. But the other aspect of it, though, that they avoid dealing with because it would tip their hand, is that they don't actually care about any of that stuff. They really don't. They don't actually care about rights and equality and justice. And, you know, we established that in citing the Anya Muzicek story at the start of the top of the program here tonight. They're only interested in inciting these intergroup conflicts to the extent that they can be leveraged for political effect in order to win elections and secure legislation, all of which is designed to advance their ongoing revolution against capitalism and Western civilization. So, there you go.
Which I think is just unfortunate that they do that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you look back, Abraham Lincoln, but who was it that actually freed the slaves?
No, you got it right. Abraham Lincoln. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was a Republican.
Yeah. Well, they would tell you that the parties have changed a lot between then and now, and that's true, but the point remains that the principles at issue in slavery are not championed by the Democrats.
Yeah.
Appreciate your call as always, Corey. All right, so one last point I wanted to make regarding this story locally that took place. The woman who was stabbed 14 times here in Minneapolis. She's 26-year-old Morgan Evanson. Excuse me. She was stabbed 14 times by a Somali man. We'll come back momentarily. All right, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855, the number to join us if you feel so inclined. Always appreciate your contributions to the program. I wanted to touch back briefly on this story coming out of the local ABC affiliate from earlier this month, just before Christmas. A woman was stabbed 14 times. In Minneapolis, 26-year-old Morgan Evanson. She was attacked December 13th while walking home from her job at the Apple Store on Hennepin Avenue. And she was being followed by a guy, and as soon as she recognized it and turned around, he charged her. There was a struggle during which, you know, she talks about feeling like she was being stung. She was actually being stabbed. Her kidney was lacerated. She was cut 14 times. Now, one of the things, the understated things that I find noteworthy about this story is her reaction in the aftermath, what she's saying now, what she told reporters, what she wants the world to know. She wants her attacker to know that she survived. She wants her attacker to know that he will be caught. She seeks justice, but she seeks it in a very particular fashion. She wants the government to do its job. And this is something that is, you know, we don't think of these moments and the reaction by victims to these moments as inherently political. If anything, we think of them as apolitical. But everything is political, okay? Everything is. And this is a deeply political statement that we're about to play here for you from this gal, in terms of what it is that she's seeking. And I want to share it with you, and then we'll expound upon it here.
I wasn't going to let him hurt me. I think as a young woman, you hear stories, you know, of attackers and being weaker. And I was really, really trying to be brave. I don't want to change who I am and be scared. I don't want to be afraid to walk, you know, a few blocks home from work. I don't want to have that fear. So as soon as he's caught it, you know, I'll be so thankful, and I hope that this can never happen to anybody else from him, because it's just horrible.
And what she's describing there, that sense of security, that sense that she can walk safely down the street with a reasonable expectation that she's going to get to her destination without being assaulted, that right there, that is liberty. That's it. That's what it feels like. That sense of security, that sense of expectation, that sense of peace that you are not going to be attacked. And that in the event you are, as she was, that actions are going to be taken by a competent state to address the situation, to wield the retaliatory force that we have vested the state with in order to pursue and secure justice. That is a worthy goal. That is what we ought to be fighting for. And that's what the proper use of and purpose of government is. And the reason why I wanted to focus on that and pull her comment out of there and share it to you and give you this angle on it, this perspective, is because I think those of us on the right, particular my little corner of the right, libertarians, we tend to undersell, if not dismiss, the value of government. Yeah, you know, how's that sounding from a libertarian? The value of government. But there is. Government has a value that it is established to secure, that is established to seek and to promote. And that value is justice. It's the institutionalized monopoly on force, so that that force can be channeled and wielded to the singular purpose of retaliating against those who initiate force and keeping the peace, so that we can live, as Morgan Evanson describes, in peace, in security, without fear as we walk down the street. 651-989-5855. The number to join us. Let's go to Carrie in Blaine. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
How you doing?
Pretty good. I'm finding it really entertaining how Islam is demonstrating itself once again to be the religion of peace in the wake of the declaration of Jerusalem as the Israeli capital.
Yeah, there is a nice little irony there, isn't there?
And, of course, you have the usual suspects and the celebrities out there completely behind the Palestinians.
You know? Right, right. Well, it's not just the celebrities, it's the institutions. I mean, you go down, you know, Ben Shapiro and his podcast had the breakdown of all the different votes that have been taken condemning states generally for this atrocity or that atrocity, and like half of them, in some cases, a supermajority of the resolutions passed, depending on the body that was doing it at the UN, was directed against Israel. Now, are we to believe that the overwhelming majority of the world's problems originate in the state of Israel? That's where it's all coming from. No, that's the problem. Now, clearly, the world is arrayed against that country, and it's quite bizarre, actually, and telling. It's demonstrative of how unique Israel is in that part of the world, that it manages to attract the hostility and the ire and the attention that it does, because it stands out from the nations around it as being a nation that's relatively liberty affirming and free.
Yeah, I did love Nikki Haley's speech, though. I've been waiting for somebody to say that for a long, long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate your call, Carrie. This is the kind of the conundrum that I find myself in as of late, and I've been saying this more often than I ever thought I would on this program, but it's becoming more and more difficult for me to sustain my never Trump fervor, right? Now, you know, like I've said before, I say that jokingly, never Trump is gone. Like, it doesn't exist anymore, right? But I have been a Trump critic. And I think with good reason, and I stand by the things that I have criticized Donald Trump for. That said, his presidency has unfolded very differently than a lot of us feared it would. He has governed, if you take his name off of it and just look at the things that he's done and the things that have been accomplished during this first year of his administration, on its face, you got to acknowledge that it's looking pretty conservative, certainly a lot more so than I would have expected when the guy took the oath of office. And not only is it pretty conservative, like generally, it's extraordinarily conservative relative to previous administrations, including previous Republican administrations. And that's particularly the case when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to the ways in which Trump has chosen to engage with the rest of the world. From USA Today, they have a list of 10 ways Trump upended the world order in 2017. They write, President Trump vowed he would put America first in world affairs, even if it disrupted the way the world operated. And boy, did he. Here are 10 ways he snubbed world conventions and provoked international outcries. First of all, he took a call from Taiwan's leader. As president-elect, before he even took the oath of office, Trump broke with diplomatic tradition and angered China when he took a congratulatory phone call from Taiwan's democratically elected president. China considers Taiwan a breakaway province, and the U.S. does not have formal diplomatic ties with Taiwan. Trump later smoothed mainland China's fury by reaffirming that the communist regime in Beijing is the only legitimate government of the country. Now, that one, I think, is more accidental than intentional. You know, Trump's not the kind of guy who, if he were to get a call from a world leader, he would sit there and think about what the diplomatic consequences are going to be of taking it or not, right? Like, he's just like, oh, the president of Taiwan? Sure. That's a box I haven't checked. Sure, I'll pick up that call. That's fine. He pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. On January 23rd, his first official workday in office, Trump pulled the United States out of a major trade pact negotiated by President Barack Obama with 11 countries that bordered the Pacific Ocean. Calling his move a great thing for the American worker, the other nations vowed to push ahead on the agreement without the U.S. Now, this stuff, the trade stuff, because the next thing they mention here is his vow to scrap NAFTA, that, I would argue, goes against the grain of conservatism, which is, of course, traditionally free market. You know, and you know, you can get into the nuance of just how free market these free trade agreements are, and that's a fine debate to have. But nonetheless, the impulse, certainly as articulated during his campaign, from Donald Trump has been very protectionist, very state interventionist in terms of walling off America from the rest of the world. But as you continue down this list of things, this is relatively good stuff. He imposed the travel ban, right? Trump, in his first week in office, issued a travel ban on people from 8 countries, including 6 that have Muslim majority populations. Federal courts blocked the ban. The list of countries changed. And the Supreme Court approved the latest version, which affects Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and Chad, while legal challenges continue. The ban has been decried by other countries around the world. He battled NATO over money. In his first meeting with NATO allies in May, Trump scolded their chronic underfunding of the alliance and refused to explicitly endorse the mutual defense clause of the treaty. In June, Trump affirmed the U.S. commitment to aid any of the 26 NATO nations, or 28, if attacked. He did so after other NATO leaders said they were prepared to maintain collective self-defense even without American support. You know, so now, you know, I'm a fan of NATO, but the idea that you're going to leverage a little bit in order to get them to pay more, that's perfectly fine. And then, of course, you know, the coup de grace, as far as the left is concerned, he pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. Trump ordered the government in June to stop implementing the Obama-era Paris Climate Agreement, which called for the U.S. and other nations to reduce carbon emissions that contribute to global warming. Now, that's not really a fair... Actually, that is an accurate statement regarding what the Paris Climate Accord does. It called for something. Didn't actually facilitate it happening, right? Like, there was no actual requirement that any country do anything at all. And yet, pulling out of it has been characterized as, you know, this horrendous insult to the planet by Donald Trump. I love it. I'm glad he did it. And there are a number of other things on here that I'm glad he did. Let's talk to Dan in Inver Grove Heights. How you doing?
Yeah. Hi. Walter, could you please tell me, do you have any idea what we could do or what can we do to get Live PD to be in Minneapolis? I assume you know what I'm talking about when I talk about the show, the TV show Live PD on A&E. And the second question is, do you know where we can go to see hard statistics on violent crime in Minneapolis that tells you the race of the person, you know, it describes the person, what they did, you know, all that kind of stuff on a daily basis? I want to know, you know, everything, you know, or as much as they can release.
Well, I don't have the answer to either of those questions. I'm not a big TV viewer myself, so that's my first exposure to that program. I'm sure it's a fine show. And as far as the statistics are concerned, I don't know. I'm sure they probably are available, but they're probably not available easily and for political reason, as you well know. I mean, the idea that we ought to, you know, it tells you how ridiculous things have gotten, where the description of a suspect is considered to be somehow discriminatory. Well, what about the behavior of the suspect? Like, it's not like we're randomly deciding that we're going to call people of certain races suspects for things that they didn't do. Right. It's that people are going out and doing things, and they happen to be of whatever persuasion, and so they get described as such for an objective, logical reason, which is to try to pursue them and apprehend them and make them accountable for the crime.
Exactly. God bless you, Walter.
Yep.
I love what you do. I listen to you when I can, and you're wonderful.
Well, I appreciate that, and thanks for calling in.
I appreciate you. Take care.
All right. Have a good one.
Well, a quick Google search reveals that violent crime in Minneapolis nudged up slightly in 2016, according to the Star Tribune. This was released January 4th of this year, so I'd assume we would be getting 2017 numbers here soon. It says, an official tally showed 4,605 violent crime incidents defined as homicide, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault reported across the city. It was a 4.3% increase over 2015. And, you know, basically everything is up except homicide.
Well, there you go. It's not looking good. And I've said it before when we've talked about different crime stories that have taken place in Minneapolis. It's changed from even just a few years ago, you know, when I was a young buck running around trying to get things done in downtown Minneapolis, right? I mean, maybe it's just the audacity of youth that you think you're invulnerable and you don't really think about the potential of being a victim of crime, but it was never something that I was worried about. It just wasn't at any point. Nowadays, I would not go down there certain times of the day at all. And I would be nervous about taking my kids down there.
It says here the neighborhoods with the highest crime were Downtown West, Hawthorne, East Phillips, Jordan, and Falwell.
Interesting. So that's not even downtown. I mean, that's like around Minneapolis.
Well, according to the map, it shows like downtown is actually the darkest, which means it had the most crime.
Right.
And then it all swaths up north and west.
Yeah. Well, and the crime in downtown, it's not originating there natively. It's coming from the other surrounding areas around the city. So
surrounding areas around the country.
Yeah, well, that's true. Absolutely. All right, when we come back, we're going to get into, you know, there's a pro-Trump singer who can't get anybody to care about her plight whatsoever. She's accusing Lewandowski, a former campaign manager, of grabbing her buttocks. Closing argument. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 651-989-5855, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. You come to the end of the year, and people do their retrospectives on what happened January through December. What was 2017 like? How was it defined? You know, what was the latest, the greatest, the biggest, the baddest, the good, the bad, the ugly, and what have you? And that, of course, applies to politics as well. There's a piece over here at Politico that talks about what Congress actually did in 2017. And just that headline in and of itself is somewhat provocative because, you know, I've said and meant it when I said it that Congress hasn't really done anything at all. Certainly there haven't been until the recent passage of tax cuts, a major legislative accomplishment, a signature bill, so to speak, of the Trump administration. But nonetheless, things have actually been getting done in Congress. They just haven't received a whole lot of fanfare. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app, two ways to stream the program. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. You can catch up on past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument right there in your iHeartRadio app. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us this evening. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. So from Politico here, April 4th, 2017. Wasn't an especially notable day for news, but it was a big day for America's meteorologists. That Tuesday afternoon, the House of Representatives quietly passed legislation to overhaul the nation's weather forecasting system, sending to President Donald Trump's desk the first big revamp of that critical piece of national infrastructure in more than two decades. The 98-page bill authorized more than $170 million worth of investment, including innovative projects like a set of microsatellites to watch for several weather events and track space weather. The upgrades not only affect meteorologists, but are expected to help save lives through better storm planning, smarter disaster response, and more reliable weather prediction weeks or even months in advance. In Washington, it's fair to say almost nobody noticed the Weather Research and Forecasting Innovation Act. The headlines instead were Neil Gorsuch's nomination moving through the Senate and the repeated White House attempts to revive its stalled Obamacare repeal. 2 weeks later, when Trump signed the weather bill into law, a moment of bipartisan success, even as Democrats assailed his administration for its few tangible accomplishments, The White House sent a cursory 49-word email with the news. There was no signing ceremony, no primetime coverage. In an era of congressional dysfunction, it's a perennial frustration for lawmakers on Capitol Hill that much of the stuff they do get done is often just ignored. That's par for the course in a city where politics is covered as a blood sport and policy as a wonky sideline. And some say the problem has become even more extreme this year as Trump often ignores the chance to highlight minor triumphs of good government in favor of meaningless publicity events and Twitter feuds. Now, there are a couple of different things they note there that I think are worth our attention. The first is this difference, this dichotomy or distinction, I should say, between the things that are, shall we say, sexy and get the coverage, the things that motivate the conversation. We talked about this, we skirted alongside it at least last hour when we were talking about the types of stories that get covered, like the story of the gal who got stabbed 14 times here in Minneapolis by the Somali man, how that doesn't get coverage, but in the hypothetical situation where it was reversed, you would get all sorts of coverage, right? The reason being, there are certain narratives which are either serve political or commercial effect. It either goes along with a supporting a narrative that somebody wants to advance for political reasons, or media outlets know that it's something that's going to generate a lot of interest, generate a lot of conversation, and therefore a lot of clicks, a lot of likes, a lot of sharing, and what have you. And those are the things that choose to get focused on. Now, weather research and meteorology obviously doesn't fit in that category. You know, in the best case scenario, is this something that I think there ought to have been all sorts of fanfare about, the fact that they passed this bill? No. But a mention might have been smart, particularly from the White House, which brings us to the second point that I derive from this piece over at Politico, which is that one of Donald Trump's failures is that, and it's a two-sided coin. On the one hand, he fails to seize upon moments where the wind is actually blowing in his favor and he could capitalize, you know, if he just used his Twitter account to draw attention to the things that are going right, that are going well, that are going in his favor, to favorable news, if he rode the tide, so to speak, then he could accomplish a lot more than he has, number one. But number two, and the other side of that coin, is his tendency to create headwinds that did not previously exist by using his Twitter account to gin up controversies that don't serve any political or legislative effect whatsoever. And in fact, muddy the waters and detract from his accomplishments, such as getting a bill such as this through Congress. Over at Bloomberg, Republicans and Democrats in Congress are spoiling for a big fight in the new year. Profound differences between House and Senate Republicans may play a big role in GOP fights with Democrats on how the legislative agenda plays out when Congress returns in January. House Republicans, especially conservative members, have been energized by their ability to rally around the tax overhaul and to limit demands from Democrats and from the Senate on the stopgap spending measure that closed out the year and will keep the federal government running through through January 19th. With the tax plan now law, House Speaker Paul Ryan has set his sights on another long-held Republican goal, reforming safety net standbys, such as temporary assistance for needy families and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, popularly known as welfare and food stamps, and used by millions of poor, disabled, and elderly Americans. Ryan also spoke on December 6th of overhauling Medicare, calling it the biggest entitlement. Now, I am both shocked and thrilled by this pivot from Paul Ryan. This is what has been the, you know, it, from a policy perspective, one of the biggest thorns in my side with Republican control of everything in Washington over the past year, is that not only have they not done a whole lot of note, but they've ignored the elephant in the room, right? Which is entitlement spending. You know, there's headlines right now, and we haven't talked about it as of yet, but But Trump is, you know, playing hardball, according to, as some people have described it, with the UN by cutting some of their funding. You know, he's cutting something like $250 million from the UN. Now, look, I approve of that, right? That's good. That's great. We should cut more funding. And that's just it, is that that's a fraction of what goes to the UN. It's a fraction of what we spend on them. But that's not where the real money is. You know, you get these focuses during campaigns and in policy discussions about so-called waste, fraud, and abuse, and things like foreign aid, right? Foreign aid is a popular thing to demonize, and with good reason. We shouldn't be giving out a bunch of foreign aid to countries that hate us. But that's not where the money is. That's not where we're going to find ourselves saving a lot of money that's going to make a difference to the deficit and a difference to the overall debt. The elephant in the room is, if you want to go for something that's really going to make a difference, you have to go after entitlements. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I haven't heard of this gal. This is another gal that I haven't heard of. A lot of people I haven't heard of who are in the news today. Over at Politico, the woman accusing President Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, of unwanted touching at a Trump International Hotel party last month has filed a sexual assault report with the Metropolitan Police Department detailing the incident. Joy Villa, 31, a singer and Trump supporter, who is exploring a congressional bid in Florida. Oh, I didn't see that aspect of the story. Exploring a congressional bid. I'm sure that has nothing whatsoever to do with what's going on right here. Says Lewandowski slapped her on the butt hard twice. Hard twice. Even after she voiced an objection. Now, I laugh, right? Now, I don't mean to discount what occurred. Like, obviously, what Lewandowski, assuming this is true, right? Assuming her account is correct, is accurate. If he did this, it was wrong, right? It was beyond the pale. It was inexcusable. But it's not on the level of, I mean, she's filing a sexual assault complaint because she got slapped on the butt. Oh, excuse me, hard. And twice. Okay. Villa said she provided the names of two eyewitnesses to the police department when she filed her report the day before Christmas after Politico published details of her account. She said that she told a detective she wanted to file a sexual harassment claim, but was informed that the incident she was describing was considered a misdemeanor and that it belonged with the sex assault unit. I wonder if that wasn't one department trying to shove the issue onto another. The detective I talked to said that sexual harassment is what happens in the workforce, Villa said in an interview on Tuesday. The detective told me what you described happened to you is sexual assault. Villa said she is planning a trip to Washington to meet with investigators. Now, if you were to look at the comments on this story on social media and in the webpage here at Politico, you would see not a lot of support for Ms. Villa. There isn't too many people, and really I haven't seen anyone, who's coming out willing to defend her in any way. And this, of course, makes sense, right? Because from the left, their argument is, well, you sided with Trump. You campaigned for him. You sung at one of his events. Therefore, you're dead to us, right? That's their position. So they don't care. Which, again, goes back to what we talked about last hour with the hypocrisy of the left, that they don't actually care about these things that they claim to care about. They don't actually care about sexual assault, right, or the treatment of women or any of that. They only care about advancing a political narrative with the cause of or the objective of securing political power or advancing an agenda. That's what they care about. She did not help them with that. In fact, and they regard her as a traitor to that effort. So they don't really care whether her story is true or false. And they think that she, that basically they're using the same argument that they claim to detest in other contexts, which is that she deserved it, right? You know, this is what you ought to expect when you roll with people like that. That's basically the argument that you're seeing from the left. And of course, on the right, nobody's really particularly interested in defending her because they also see her as a traitor because she's speaking out not against Trump directly, but acting against his interests by bringing Lewandowski back into the headlines. And so, you know, it's a pox from both houses on Ms. Davila. Probably not the best public relations move on her part, particularly if she's thinking about a campaign for Congress. I'd be interested to know more about that, what district she's talking about, where she comes from, whether she's going to run as a Republican or a Democrat or whatever the case may be. That'll be something worth watching. From Newsweek, AT&T plans to lay off and fire more than 1,000 workers starting early next year, according to local reports. Across the Midwest, an estimated 600 workers were notified they were being laid off by the company on December 16th, a week before AT&T announced it was doling out $1,000 bonuses to 200,000 of its employees in celebration of the Republican Party's tax overhaul. Now, with those two paragraphs, you can imagine where I found this, right? Where this came to my attention. It was shared online by lefties. And it's kind of this, oh, the hypocrisy of AT&T is the argument, right? It's like, of course, this is them. They were covering themselves by announcing their $1,000 bonuses to their employees. They were covering the fact that they were actually laying people off because they're an evil corporation that doesn't deserve a tax cut. Well, you know, $1,000 to 200,000 employees is pretty significant, a not too insignificant chunk of change, which seems to indicate that AT&T is not shy about throwing cash around to people who have earned it. So why would they be laying people off? What's the real reason why they're laying people off? Well, we continue in the article. The telecommunications giant told the Chicago Tribune in a statement that most of the affected workers are from its landline and other legacy service sectors, but the company did not say how many workers total would still be employed in 2018. Sounds like a market decision to me, right? Like, how many do you have a landline, Brad?
No. I haven't had a landline since like freshman year of college, and they did a study. I remember freshman year of college, they said we have a landline and you should have one because if there's an emergency, like, we'll send out an emergency call to the landline can hear what's going on.
Right.
And I had one, and then I remember we called them the CAs, basically the student floor advisors, came around and knocked on our door and asked everybody if they had a landline. And 7% of people had a landline, so they just canceled the service.
Yeah. Right.
And I haven't had one since then.
Right. Yeah, I can't remember the last time I had a landline phone. Like, it's been a long time.
Even my parents, who are baby boomers, don't have a landline anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my in-laws do, but, you know, they bought their houses, you know, years and years and years ago, decades ago. So, you know, it makes sense that it's not like you're going to get rid of it necessarily once you have it. You know, it's an institution. But, yeah, people who have moved recently or, you know, have come of age recently or whatever the case may be, likely do not have landlines. And so it makes sense, doesn't it? And we're talking about 1,000 jobs. We're not talking about they're laying off, you know, half their workforce. 1,000 jobs. They're laying people off from a particular segment of their company, which is quite literally obsolete. The market has said bye-bye. Now, the same lefties who are upset about this and who are feigning outrage, and it is feigned outrage, like, they don't actually care about these people. We know that, right? But the feigning of outrage over this comes from folks who, if they were in charge in like 1908, or thereabouts, would have us, they would be fully supporting the unionization of blacksmiths and their protests in the streets, blocking dirt roads against the scourge of the coming horseless carriage because it's going to put them out of business, right? Like, these are people who are standing athwart, obstructing progress. Like, they don't want to see the future come. Certainly not for free. Like, they want to maintain, nobody should ever have to change. You know, that's just, as an aside that I probably shouldn't get into right now with Brad, this is kind of the latest Star Wars movie sucks argument of nothing's ever supposed to change. Everything's supposed to stay the same.
It's not even that, Walter. It's not even that. I understand that Star Wars is supposed to change, but it's a bad movie overall.
I got you.
I'm pro, like, change in Star Wars. Like, I came of age during episode one. That was awesome to me.
Sure.
And that was obviously a change of direction from this latest trilogy. But, like, when I saw The Force Awakens, like, I was like, oh, you know, that was they hit the post. Like, you know, they didn't do anything special out of the ordinary, but, you know, it was a Star Wars movie. I get that. And this one was worse. And we can't continue to, like, just accept the mediocrity of Star Wars and still call it Star Wars. Like, it's just, we're done with it now. Like, we've played it out. Star Wars is done. It's like Leonard Skinner playing with their only original member being the bassist and still calling themselves Leonard Skinner. It's just like, call yourself something else, just rebrand, do something else. We're over with Star Wars.
That's exactly the way I feel about Star Trek. I feel as though they need to call that something else because it's departed so far from what it was ever supposed to be. It's unrecognizable at this point. My issue was, and to tie it back into what I was talking about here, is that what you just articulated was a qualitative judgment of the film itself. And what I'm hearing from a lot of folks is less a qualitative judgment of the merits of the film and how it fits into the overall franchise, and more of a, this is what my fan theory was, and the movie wasn't that, therefore it's bad.
No, I mean, I didn't even have a fan theory going into the movie. I only went because my dad wanted to see it.
Sure.
And he invited me along, and I was not impressed.
Sure. But to tie that back into what we're talking about here in terms of, you know, AT&T and their layoffs and the advancement, the progress of technology and what have you, there is this kind of, I guess Luddite is the right word, sentiment that has a home on the left where to be completely fair, it has a home on the right as well, but on the right, it takes more of a form in cultural issues and things like, you know, the social infrastructure and what have you, as opposed to economic stuff. But on the left, they would have us living in the Bronze Age, right? Like, they do not like the advancement of technology because it's inevitably going to put somebody out of a job. And, you know, the object lesson for people, particularly young people, in a story like this is that you're not going to get a job, like, most likely. You are not going to get a job that you stay in for 40 years and accumulate seniority and retirement and then stay with the same company. And when you retire, they give you a big cake and throw a big party because you've known everybody there for four decades and what have you. That's not the wave of the future. The wave of the future is, you have multiple careers, not just multiple jobs, multiple careers where you have a completely different skill set or an evolving skill set that changes over time because technology is changing so fast. Infrastructure is changing so fast. The way we go about being productive is in such a state of flux, and the pace of it is changing so quickly that in order to survive and thrive, you have to adapt, which, you know, is something that's always been true of human beings. But somewhere along the line, certain folks, particularly on the left, started to think that somehow we could freeze today in amber and never, ever have to change and always get paid the same amount of money to do the same thing no matter what. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, 651-989-5855. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I won't mention the brand name because they are not a paying sponsor, but they should become one because I'm about to sing their praises. I have a tumbler, you know, one of these insulated beverage cups that you put your hot and or cold beverages in, that I bring on a routine basis here to the program. And I fill it up with coffee for my evening diatribes. And I've gotten to the point where I've actually come to expect that coffee just stays hot for, you know, 45 minutes, an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. Just as hot as it was when you first poured it in, that it just remains that way all the time. I'm using a styrofoam cup, and I'm shocked, absolutely shocked, that my coffee's cold after 30 minutes. It's like, how did this happen?
Physics, Walter.
Yeah, I know. We've come a long way in society. The pinnacle of technological achievement, the insulated tumbler. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream this program. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. You can catch up on podcasts of past shows by doing a search for Closing Argument right there in your iHeartRadio app. 651-989-5855. The number to join us. Appreciate you doing so. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. Something controversial coming out of the Minneapolis City Council. I'm shocked. I'm shocked and amazed. From the Star Tribune, add local government transparency and accountability to the list of 2017 losers in Minneapolis, thanks to an unnecessarily shifty year-end move by the city council. In case you missed the news while preparing for the holidays in your own year-end rush, the council, led by Secret Santa and outgoing President Barb Johnson. Is this actually labeled as an editorial? Yes, it's the editorial board. Okay, I just wanted to make sure. Because it's hard to tell nowadays whether or not something is considered commentary or hard news.
AT&T shared a fraction of their bounty.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Man, editorial board going hard against Barb Johnson.
I do remember in my first radio gig, when I was working with the news director on writing my first news story, I said something about writing a story about a fire, and I said the blaze was subdued, and he laughed at me, and he said, "Oh, that's way over the top. Keep it vanilla." And so, it's a good principle to have, though.
Right, right, right. Yeah, exactly. If you actually care about,
just say what happened, yeah, not what you think happened.
Yeah. So, Barb Johnson voted unanimously along with the rest of the city council on December 15th to increase their annual salaries for themselves and the mayor by $10,000. Now, I got to tell you, as a city council member in a relatively small city in the Northwest Metro, the idea of being paid $1,000 is pretty amazing. $10,000 is their raise.
Just wait to see how much they're actually paid.
Oh, I didn't get that far down. Oh, here
just
it is.
Wait, it's down there.
Okay, we'll get to it. We'll let you guys anticipate. The numbers are less troublesome than the process or lack thereof. This going back again to the Star Tribune editorial board. The raises were not on the pre-meeting agenda. No council committees had considered them, and there was no public comment period or public hearing. They also weren't included in the city's recently approved $1.4 billion 2018 budget. Now, I was about to say that they may not have been legally required to have a public hearing on this, but that budget piece does raise a question, though, because, you know, if this had been included in the budget, then it would have been deliberated at that time. And even then, you could make the argument that, you know, they were hiding it in the midst of everything else that's in the bloated Minneapolis budget. But to do it this way is certainly underhanded. Continuing with the Star Tribune, Johnson, again, Barb Johnson, ending an otherwise solid career as a voice of reason on the council, introduced the resolution explaining during the meeting that the increases will put Minneapolis council members in similar salary territory with their full-time counterparts in Denver and Boston, but still $20,000 below those in Portland and Seattle. Well, thank God. We're not Portland. We're not Seattle. We're not that highfalutin. You're not going to get that kind of value out your city council, but an extra $10,000. Minneapolis council members who will be paid, here it is, $98,695 next year. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. $98,000 to be a city council member. That is insane. And you know what's reflective of? Because, you know, the argument that I'm sure they would make is, well, you know, it's a full-time job. Yeah, it probably is. It probably is because you've made it that. You've made it that with all of your committees and your subcommittees and your you know, organizational get-togethers to discuss how you're going to single-handedly from the perch of the Twin Cities change the climate of the earth and undo, you know, injustice from 400 years ago and what have you. Like, it, all the things you've taken on above and beyond the business of a city, of a municipality, which is pretty basic, right? It's, you know, because the council doesn't even run the city. All they do is set policy. The people who run the city are the staff. And they're probably not getting paid this. Guaranteed, a lot of them aren't. Probably, maybe the city administrator, manager, whoever. A few other people are getting paid that kind of money. But to get paid this just to show up to meetings and set policy is utterly ridiculous. Anyway, those city council members did receive 2.5% annual increases for the past 4 years after being paid a measly $80,354 with no increases in 2012 and 2013. You guys remember those wild years, that wasteland of time during which Minneapolis City Council members were only making $80,000 to show up to meetings and vote on crazy stuff that nobody ought to be engaged in. Despite Johnson's efforts, it's difficult to make good comparisons. St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman earns $126,000 a year. Oh, that's just absurd. And the Capital City's council members are paid $63,000 for what is supposed to be a part-time job. So it's part-time work that they're getting paid these salaries for. They're not even putting in 40 hours at their nonsense.
Let's see. It says I don't think it actually gives the median income, but it just says median household income among minorities is below that of whites by over $17,000. So it'd be interesting to see, like, what the actual median income is, because if they want, like, to pass these $15 an hour laws, like, why can't they live by themselves? Oh, here we go. The Twin Cities contribute 63.8% of the gross domestic product of Minnesota, measured by gross metropolitan product per resident, which is $62,054.
Wow.
But that's the Twin Cities as a whole, not necessarily Minneapolis, but still it's pretty indicative of how much money a person makes.
Well, and that's your household, right? So that could be two income earners. That could be multiple jobs.
No, per resident.
Well, that's per resident. Okay. Well, the point remains that it's absolutely obscene, the amount of money. But that's not even my chief focus here. My chief focus is the fact that they know they're doing this in spite of the fact that they're making efforts, you know, trying to sneak it in the last minute and before Christmas and what have you. They know that they knew this story was going to be written, right? They knew somebody was going to notice, but they did it anyway because they know they're going to get away with it. They know people in Minneapolis do not care. And to the extent they care, they're going to gripe about it a little bit, maybe on social media, but they're not actually going to change their voting behavior to retaliate against this stuff. We'll talk to Raymond in St. Paul when we return. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855. The number to join us. We were just talking about the Minneapolis City Council giving themselves a $10,000 raise, which begs the question, they make more than $10,000? Like, what? Turns out they make $90,000+ for part-time work. Nice job if you can get it. I mean, that is quite the gig. Let's go to Raymond in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Brother Walt. First off, to tell you, I am very proud when you like to be from the Boondocks and all that stuff. And to tell you, I knew we come on the last, I think, 4 to 6 years, like, because I'm in Dan Bopp's area. Sorry to say, I'm not proud of that. But he was making part-time $40,000, and it's just like, I always thought that was way too much for what he got. He didn't work like he deserved, like, $5,000 for us.
Well, and these are the same people who complain about, like, CEO pay and how much money shareholders get for coming. It's like, at least those people are actually generating value. And at least the pay is coming from people who are choosing to engage in the transaction. Like, a CEO gets paid because the board of directors decides they're going to get paid, right? The shareholders get paid because that's the product of the agreement that they've entered into in order to own in concert the corporation. Like, it's part of an agreement. Nobody's being forced to do anything, as opposed to sitting around part-time at the Minneapolis City Hall, and you're making 90-some thousand dollars or north of 100 if you're the mayor, because you're literally holding, at the end of the day, literally holding a gun to people's head and taking their money through taxation.
You're right, you know, and that's what it is. Like Boston, for example, everything he does is just for his name, and, you know, he does nothing, and he won't even talk to those of us people, just the common, you know, not his little friends over in the Lake Phelan area, you know, and he doesn't even come around and talk to us in the voting time. It's just like, really?
Right.
Like, it's kind of shame and all that.
Yeah.
All these people get away from me. We need to start taking our party back, you know, conservatives, that truly conservative, get the people's head out of their tail end and, you know, get our power back and say, yeah, we're going to cut that and give you money back to the people. I don't need $40,000 for a part-time job. I'm not greedy like you. Sorry.
You could probably win on that alone. Like, that's your whole platform. I'll do the job for half the price. You know what I'm saying? I mean, people would respect that. Appreciate your call, as always, Raymond.
Back me then, brother?
Yeah. Well, yeah. We'll talk about it when the time comes. All right, appreciate it. Yeah, Merry Christmas. All right. So, from the Star Tribune, in a message to political supporters, Attorney General Lori Swanson said Tuesday that she would file a lawsuit with other state attorneys general asking the court to overturn a federal decision that repeals a rule designed to keep access to the internet free and open. There we go again with the biased reporting over there at Ye Olde Star Tribune. So they're presuming that they've adopted as fact that the effect of net neutrality is to keep the internet free and open. That's under debate. And in fact, I wouldn't even say it's under debate. It's 180 degrees opposed to objective reality. Because here's the thing. You want to keep something free, you remove force. You don't impose force. You don't initiate force. You don't say, this is what you're going to do. You don't mandate. You don't regulate. You leave it alone. That's how you make something free. Anyway, continuing at the Star Tribune. The move would challenge the Federal Communications Commission's recent overturning of net neutrality, a 2015 regulation mandating that internet companies treat all traffic equally and not create slow or fast lanes for companies based on extra fees. Here's the money quote here. Without net neutrality, broadband companies are free to block content they don't want you to see, to slow it down and make it harder to access, or to prioritize content based on who pays them money, Swanson wrote to supporters in an email. So what? Like, seriously, this is portrayed as some sort of horror. So, in other words, without net neutrality, people who produce will be and engage in trade will be able to set their own prices and terms. Oh, the horror, right? What they've done is Orwellian. They've taken the notion of free and open and turned it into meaning precisely the opposite. But we're going to make the internet free by holding a gun to people's heads and telling them how they can use it, right? We're going to make the internet free by dictating on what terms people can access a service. That's how we're going to make things free, they've decided. Pretty absurd over there at the Attorney General's office, but doesn't surprise me whatsoever. She continued, mega corporations can dominate the content people see online by paying money to obtain faster speeds. This will make it more difficult and more expensive for consumers to access the content they want. You guys remember way back in the dark ages of 2014? Is that what this was like? You know, were we unable to access the content we wanted on the internet? Were we finding ourselves in a desert of information where we couldn't obtain that which we were seeking online prior to an Obama-era regulation 2015? We're going to go back to those dark ages. It's utterly absurd, this cause that they've decided to take up on the left regarding net neutrality. And, you know, this is probably in my top five list of things that's been done under the Trump administration that I absolutely applaud and never thought would happen. Never thought it would happen because, you know, Trump being a big business guy, you know, in the pro-business sense, I just didn't think that he was going to side with deregulation on this one because so many of the big people, you know, Google, Comcast, the big boys that he probably hobnobs with were for it. All right, let's go to Chris in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program. Real quick.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, today you've been cracking me up, man, on your analogies. It's awesome. I love you, but all right. Yeah, I was just saying that these city council members get paid millions or whatever, or however much they
tens
get.
Of thousands, yeah.
That comes out of tax dollars, right?
Absolutely.
So we're paying for it.
Absolutely, we are. And we're the ones who can stop paying for it.
Yeah, that's bull, man.
All right, I appreciate it. Good note to end on. Closing argument. We'll be here tomorrow, 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.